Next on a Juno Afternoon, we'll hear from members of the Juno Community Band. Playwright Maureen Longworth will be here to talk about her new play, Blue Ticket, Ferries Out of Alaska. Charlie Harrington will tell us about the Hangar's 21st birthday festivities. And a representative from the Rock Dump will share details of tonight's community meeting. Looking at the weather, today and tonight, scattered rain showers, tonight in the low 50s. Tomorrow, also scattered rain showers with highs around 60 tomorrow night. Cloudy with lows around 50, and Thursday, just a chance of rain. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A coal-fired power plant on the Navajo Nation may survive some more years. On Monday, after more than 8 hours of debate, the Navajo Nation Council voted 18-4 to extend the lease of the Navajo Generating Station. The plant, located in Arizona, provides electricity to customers in Arizona and Nevada by burning coal from the Peabody Western Coal Company. It employs hundreds of jobs. More than 90% of the employees are Navajo. The legislation passed with a number of amendments and dealt with items such as water rights and payments. The tribe entered a lease with utility entities in three states to keep the plant open through 2019. It's up to the owners whether or not they'll approve the agreement with the tribe. An Alaska Native weaver has received one of the nation's top awards recognizing traditional folk art. Jacob Resnick reports from Juneau.
The National Endowment for the Arts Director of Folk and Traditional Arts, Clifford Murphy, says 62-year-old Anna Brown Ellers is being recognized for her outstanding Chilcot weaving.
National Heritage Fellowships are the highest national honor in folk and traditional arts. So this is really a lifetime recognition for mastery of traditional arts.
Chilcot weaving is an indigenous art form practiced by coastal people in southeast Alaska and British Columbia. Traditionally, mountain goat wool is woven on a loom and blended with thin strips of cedar bark to create elaborately patterned blankets. Born and raised in Juneau, Anna Brown Ellers' Tlingit ancestors come from the village Klukwan.
The designs on the Chilcot blanket represent our clans. So the designs say who you are and by knowing that, okay, I'm from the Whale House, people know where you're from. And it's not an ownership of the land. It's our identity.
She says her children have helped her since they were old enough to use a knife.
We prepare the materials in the springtime, and whenever mountain goat hunters call me and ask me to meet them at the ferry terminal or they send me a hide on a plane, my children and friends and relatives of mine, they all show up and work the mountain goat together. And it's not a fun job, that part, I can tell you, but it's a necessity.
Ellers and the other eight National Heritage Fellows, which include a Hawaiian slack guitarist and an African-American blues harmonica player, will each receive $25,000 and be feted at a ceremony in Washington this fall. For National Native News, I'm Jacob Resnick.
A new store has opened in Albuquerque specializing in comics by Native American artists and writers. Megan Kamarick has more.
Red Planet was launched by Lee Francis from Laguna Pueblo, whose company, Native Realities Press, publishes comics and games and also produced the Indigenous Comic-Con. He says the store creates a permanent space for what he calls indigenerds.
It's people that, you know, want to see dynamic and authentic and exciting representations of Native people in pop culture. We want to provide the space for people to come do that.
Red Planet may be one of the only stores of its kind, Francis says. It sells his company's publications and work by Native artists from around the United States and Canada.
I want to promote all of this work because this is how we change hearts and minds. You know, we put this work out around Native people that's not a historical stereotype. It can still reference history, but it makes the Native character as the main character, and it makes their story really exciting and dynamic.
About 300 people packed into the space for the opening in late May, which included Kickapoo author Aragon Starr signing copies of her Super Indian comics. Business has been brisk ever since. Francis plans to have more author signings and other events as he gears up for the next Indigenous Comic-Con in November. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamarick in Albuquerque.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Prairie Edge Trading Company, purveyors of traditional and contemporary Northern Plains Native American fine art, including buffalo skulls and robes, shields, weapons, clothing, music, and more at prairieedge.com. Wopila. The third National Gathering of American Indian Veterans takes place July 21st through the 23rd in Wheaton, Illinois, with World War II code talkers and native bands and dancers. Information at trickstergallery.com. Proud to support this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. Glad to have you with us. I'm Lori Scandling, this afternoon's volunteer host. Shelley Delaney is our producer on the board today, and thank you to her. Our first guests today are Dwayne Corbin. He is the guest conductor of the Juno Community Band and president of that organization, Sarah McNair Grove. Glad to have you with us. I learned quite a bit just in a couple of minutes chatting with you, and that is that there are a number of components to the Juno Community Band. Mm-hmm. Why don't you talk about what they are? Sarah, you're the president of the whole group. Maybe you could delineate for
us. Sure. The Juno Community Band has been in existence for about 10 years, and it really had its start with the Juno Volunteer Marching Band, which this year will be our 42nd year in the 4th of July parade. And that was started, I think, the bicentennial year when people, a couple of musicians in Juno said, we need to have a band in the parade. And so they got their friends together, and we've been in the parade ever since as the Juno Volunteer Marching Band. And then about 10 years ago, some of those players said, we need to have more wind music instead of just a couple of weeks around the 4th. So we have put together a concert band for adult wind and brass and percussion players. And we're delighted to have our first 4th of July Pops concert this year.
That's exciting. Yeah. And that subgroup is called the Taku Winds. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Dwayne?
Sure. A big difference between, say, the marching band and our indoor version, the Taku Winds, is going to be featured this Saturday night, actually, at Thunder Mountain, 7 o'clock concert. But it will be an indoor sit-down concert. We'll feature some of the same style of music, some marches and patriotic favorites like America the Beautiful, Star-Spangled Banner, the Alaska Flag Song, these sorts of traditional favorites. But also we'll venture into some other areas that we couldn't normally march to with pieces that would be celebrating American history, such as a piece called Chester, which is based on a very famous song from the Revolutionary War, the song that a lot of the soldiers were actually singing on the front lines there to sort of rally them up. And it's more of a symphonic approach, what we would call a theme and variations. You hear this really nice opening chorale version, like a choir while the wind's playing it. And then there's five variations that go through lots of different kind of transformations of the music. So we'll have some pieces like that that kind of push the boundaries of this long hundred-year or many hundreds of years tradition of the American wind band coming out of the marching and military tradition into some more modern forms that come a little bit closer to symphonic music like you would hear in a traditional orchestra concert.
Dwayne, as the guest conductor, what responsibilities do you have? Do you get to pick all of the music? Mm-hmm. Is it a collaborative process? And how did you end up being the guest conductor of the Taku Winds?
Yeah, sure. No, yes, I selected most of the pieces, actually all of them, but I gave a lot of options to the board members in the band, all the board members are performers of the Winds as well. So they're very invested in terms of they want to play music that is fun for them and that they know would connect to the audience well. And so I threw a lot of different ideas at them in terms of kind of breaking it down into different categories in terms of let's do some musicals, let's do some classic works, let's do some marches, let's do some patriotic pieces. So as conductor, my role then is to lead all the rehearsals and to be responsible for that musical side of the performance and to kind of craft what I feel like is a really great package of music that altogether would be really enjoyable for both the players and the audience.
So as a guest conductor, are you visiting Juno? And why would an organization have a guest conductor?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. This, I think, is my 12th time to Juneau. I've been associated with the symphony and with the community band here since 2009 and have done lots of different things with both groups. And I love it. I love coming to Juneau. It's an amazing city.
Where do you live?
I live in Redding, California.
Oh.
And yes, I have been in Juneau in all four seasons, so I know what it's like in all four seasons.
Pause.
Yes.
One season. And it's 47 and rainy, kind
well,
of like
this
today.
Is true.
I say
this
Juneau has a uniseason, so let's not pretend there are four seasons.
Well, right now it's 110 at home in California, so you know
it's refreshing.
It is very refreshing. Yeah, yeah. But I've been here in February as well and enjoyed the snow. So. Yeah, I think that what's fun about a guest conductor, so Todd Hunt is the usual conductor of this band, and he does an amazing job. He's also a brilliant saxophonist, and he's going to be playing a feature piece called Persuasion by Sammy Nestico, which is kind of, if you imagine a normal big band, which we would usually would be like 20 musicians in a jazz big band. Well, now we have a bigger big band. It's going to be, you know, the 40 musicians of the concert band. And he's playing this very jazzy kind of ballad solo with us. And so he'll be the lead saxophone player in the band. And it's great to have him involved that way. So you'll get to hear his amazing alto sax playing.
How is the membership of that group much different from the Juneau Symphony? Trying to think about what those differences might be. Sarah?
The differences are that we don't have string players. So we are really and in a symphony, the brass and woodwinds usually have a very limited number. Like there might be two clarinets, two flutes, two trumpets. So a band allows those brass and woodwind players to have more playing
front
opportunities.
Front and center.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, you talked about there being three components of the Juneau Community Band. One will be the marching band that will be in its 42nd year in the parade. And how we
That's
had
correct.
A parade prior to having a marching band is a mystery.
I just don't understand that. You've got to have a
right.
band.
And then the Taku Winds, who mm-hmm. will perform then Saturday night at 7 o'clock at Thunder mm-hmm. Mountain High School. What is the third component?
The third one we call the Reindeer Band, and that gets together a couple of weeks around Christmas, and we play Christmas carols, and we've been to places uh-huh. like the Pioneer Home, and we've played at First Friday, and any place that people want to hear Christmas carols.
Gotcha.
What is required to become a member of the Juneau Community Band? How would someone go about that?
Well, we do have a website and we have an email, which is junocommunityband@gmail.com. The Juneau Volunteer Marching Band is open to anybody 7th grade and older. We do have one rehearsal, which has already passed. But if you know the parade marches, you're certainly welcome to just come down on parade day and get in line with us.
And join the group. And
yes.
I believe the gathering spot is 8 a.m. at the Department of Labor.
That's
so
correct.
If that instrument is calling to you and you missed that rehearsal and you'd like to be part of the marching band, please join them on the morning of the 4th of July. What is the cost to attend the concert at TMHS on Saturday night, mm-hmm. and are tickets available online?
Yes, tickets are available online at our website, junocommunityband.org. They are available through the Jack and through Hearthside Books, and they are $20 for adults and $5 for students.
What is the total membership of the Juneau Community Band? And I assume some of those folks play in all three of those components.
Right. We do have people that play in all of them, and it really varies on who is available for each particular concert. I think we have about 35 players in the Pops concert, which is a fairly large group for us. We're usually about 25 players in Taku Winds.
Would that be your total membership in the Juneau Community Band then as well?
Probably.
Thereabouts.
Yeah. We have actually invited the Juneau Volunteer Marching Band to join Taku Winds, and that's one of the reasons why it's a little bit larger than just our normal Taku Winds.
Sure. Dwayne, what makes Juneau different from other communities in terms of what you've noticed working with those who are interested in music here?
Well, you know, the quick answer to that is there is an amazing spirit of generosity here of musicians being willing to give to any project. I mean, the multiple opera companies here, the symphony, the concert band, giving to the high school bands as they present, just trying to fill out in the many different jazz bands. There are so much going on. I mean, I looked up your population of the city, and it can't actually be 33,000. At least that's what Google says as of this morning, because you have so much more music in this town than you really should with that number of people. And so that is what's kind of the Juneau miracle to me, is to see how generous people are and how willing they are to just make some amazing music projects happen here in the city, which normally wouldn't happen in a city this size. So it's so much fun.
How did musicians here find you or you find them?
Well, the original connection was Kyle Pickett the previous conductor of the Juno Symphony, who his second orchestra was in city of Chico right next to where I live in Reading. And so I was playing percussion for him. He invited me to come up and actually do a recital at the university here, present a full recital, and then play also on a Juno Symphony concert. So that started the connection in January of 2009.
We're talking with Duane Corbin. He is the guest conductor with the Juno Community Band's Taku Winds performance, which will be this Saturday night at Thunder Mountain, and Sarah McNair Grove, who is president of the Juno Community Band. Sarah, you mentioned that folks who are in seventh grade or above can join for the marching band at the parade. How do you reach out to young people and encourage that continuance of music?
Well, several of our players are actually music teachers in the schools, and so they encourage their players to come. And I reach out to the music teachers and, you know, ask them to invite many of their students. We have in the past in some Taku Winds actually invited like the junior high or middle school band to play with us so that they prepare a piece of music and they come and sit right beside us in our concerts. So that's been really a lot of fun for both us and the students.
Have you seen a shrinkage of music offerings in the school district due to budget cuts over the last, say, half a decade?
I think that there's still the bands that we connect with are still there and the teachers are still there. So I'm going to say no, but that people might disagree with me.
Sure, I understand. Mm-hmm. Is there a dues or a fee to be part of the Juno Community Band?
No.
So it's free and open.
It's free.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm.
That's the other beautiful thing about Juno.
Yes.
Is that so much is accessible for very little.
Yeah.
Well,
mm-hmm.
Thanks for sharing the information with us as we come up on the 4th of July, which is a week from today. And the concert, again, with the Taku Winds is 7 o'clock on Saturday evening at Thunder Mountain. It is $20 for adults and $5 for kids. And you can find those tickets online. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Alaska, the economy is changing.
We are not generating enough revenue to pay our daily bills.
The energy industry is changing, and so is the landscape.
You know, you appreciate things as they become diminished in your life, right? I mean, you look at them differently when they are disappearing.
Alaska's Energy Desk is following those changes from the state capital to the North Slope to the Kenai and then Alaska. Follow us on your local public radio station.
And welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm today's volunteer host, Lori Scandling. My guest with me right now is retired physician and playwright Maureen Longworth, and she's here to talk about her new play, Blue Ticket, Ferries Out of Alaska. I do want to mention, per our guests who were here first, that the marching band and Pride Chorus will be playing live in the plaza in front of the Andrew P. Kashaveroff State Museum Archives and Library this Friday for the block party at 5 o'clock. And thank you for that reminder, Mo. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Lots of fun always in Juneau. We never run out of things to do. Let's talk about your new play. I know there is a play reading tomorrow night at the Jack at 6:30. It's on my calendar. But let's talk about the play itself, and then we'll talk about how folks can hear it and see it. Your play is called Blue Ticket-Ferries Out of Alaska, and Ferries is a play on the word of the Marine Highway Ferry, as well as what has been in the past a negative term about gay individuals.
That's right. So I just want to add real quickly, for people who can't come tomorrow night at 6:30, it's also at the Slam Auditorium at 4 on Friday.
Very good. We'll
so
make sure we,
two
to remind
people. Of that.
6:30 tomorrow night at the Jack and 4.
30. At, I mean
at
4.
4. Yeah, 4. At the AKP or APK facility next door here. So talk about the new play. It's based on research. What did you learn about this period in Alaska's history? When was it and what got you to thinking about it?
You know, when I came up for my interview as a physician with the clinic that I accepted a job with back in 92, I was told right away by others that there was this sort of expulsion of gay men from Juneau in 1963. And it was interesting to me that I couldn't find anything about it online or in history. I checked with the Juneau Empire years later, and those years that far back are not archived online. They're archived at the museum on microfiche. And so it's very labor-intensive to look into it in terms of anything written about it. And so I had such a curiosity about it that I just, as I've lived here since then, I've asked people who had lived here back in the 60s and over the years collected probably over 50 stories from people who've shared with me their impression and the way it affected them. And, you know, mostly these are straight people who noticed people disappearing from the community and then found out either right away why they were disappearing. It seems like the younger people, people that are more my age that were in high school at the time, they were told later why people disappeared. They were just told that that person was gone, like, you know, a hairdresser was gone, or the gentleman who worked in the men's department at the four-story Barron's department store downtown was just gone. Or that one man told me that the kids he played with, two boys, their father disappeared and their mother stayed with the kids. And it wasn't until he was an adult, maybe it was at a high school reunion, that the kids told him that the reason their dad had been sent away is because he had had relationships with men on the side.
Were you able to find an individual who had experienced this expulsion?
I was able to find an individual who had been interrogated. And so I had a very good idea of the kind of questions that were asked and the fact that people were sort of cornered off guard. He was pulled out of a class in the University of Washington. And obviously the teacher knew that he was going to be pulled out because the teacher didn't do anything and plainclothesmen arrived and took him out of class. But and then actually subjected him to a lie detector test.
So these were official police forces who were conducting this interrogation?
There was both police from the Juneau police, but the case I was just mentioning was Coast Guard interrogation unit, investigative unit, because this individual had had a Coast Guard roommate when he lived in Juneau, and that's who they were hunting down. And it seemed that people, if they gave names and gave information, got to stay longer. So there was some kind of a motive to give names and turn people in. And so it's even questionable if names were turned in that weren't even true, if it gave people an advantage then to stay in town.
Meaning some degree of immunity from themselves possibly being expelled.
I don't think anyone was immune, but they got more time. If they didn't give up names, they might go right out in the middle of the night and just walk away from everything.
How long did this practice continue? Were you able to determine this?
What's really amazing is it seems to have all occurred in a very short time. Like, it started insidiously and ended insidiously all in November of 1963. Maybe it went into December.
Why was the impetus for this flare-up?
Well, you know, how do we explain it? If you look at the larger history at the time, I remember in 1963, I was still in Los Angeles, and every Friday we did air raid drills and jumped under our desks and protected our heads in the fifth and sixth grade I was in at the time. And, you know, we thought that Cuba, the communists, were coming. I mean, everybody thought that. It was just this huge panic about that. Hoover actually announced that, you know, the FBI in the United States, he announced that there was a strong connection with homosexuals and communism and that homosexuals should be driven out. And so he even offered special trainings for local police force to send representatives to Washington, D.C. and get special training for expelling these potential communists from the United States or from their communities. So who knows what started it here? But when you look in history, there are documentations. That whole McCarthy era in the 50s was still looming in the consciousness of Americans, and then that was sort of flared by this whole communist scare. And then, like in Boise, the local paper did a write-up, crushed the monster, and did an analogy with homosexuality, comparing it to a cancer. And they probably imprisoned or sent away 1,500 men.
In Boise alone?
In Boise, Idaho.
Do you have a sense of how many individuals were affected here in Juneau?
I don't. You know, there isn't documentation here. I'll tell you, I have too many things to include in a two-hour play. I've tried to include so many stories because, I mean, there were legislators sent away. There were judges who moved because they knew they were going to go. They were going to be driven out, and so to keep their reputation, moved away. So there's just no way to figure it all out. There were, you know, a hairdresser, a theater actor, a teacher, the Barron's Department salesman, a pharmacist. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on. And so all the stories people told me were about the one that they knew. Like one woman in her 80s said, you know, she used to walk by the drugstore every day and bring her girls in, her little girls, to see the pharmacist because he was so nice to them. And they had recently moved to Juneau. They were an immigrant family. And he called them all by name. And then one day they went and he was gone. and they just said he's been sent away. He's not going to be back. And she, of course, worried that he could be sick or, you know, and never knew then, and then found out later, you know, and she'd lived through World War II in Europe and seen horrible things happen and thought it was just awful when she realized
oppressed and killed homosexuals as well as Jews and gypsies.
Yeah.
Maureen, you talk about the challenge of turning life stories or life, you know, life-changing stories into a two-hour play. Talk about that process. How did you make that transition from what you knew, what you learned, into a piece about real people?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, I felt sort of a real responsibility to give the history because I felt like it was just too important to not let people realize what had gone on. And so much of gay history is not spoken of. You know, people don't tell their kids because they are afraid to say it out loud, even what gay is, you know. And so I first thought I would try to do it similar to the Laramie Project, where it was the actual true stories. But it never took off in my mind and in my creative stream. And as soon as I decided to make it fiction and a love story, as soon as I created the characters that would be the tellers of the story by experiencing it in their lives, it just zoomed right out. It just had a life of its own. And I've never written fiction before. And it was sort of an interesting thing because you have a lot of freedom then. You know, I can show things in any way through any character. Like there's one interesting thing that was in the Capital City Weekly. Clara Miller did a great story last week about the play, and she read the whole script, and she was struck by one of the scenes is a bank calls up a person in their home and says, you know, this house is for sale, your house next door to you. And they offer it to the person really cheap. So it was like an offer you couldn't pass up because you'd never be able to buy a house that cheap. And the reason was the guy had been sent away on the ferry. And so he was losing the house even though he'd put all his money into it. So the person who bought it got this really good deal. Well, you know, the person who told me that knew the guy who'd bought it from the theater because she was also an actress at the time, and he was in the theater. And he was in the middle of a play and had to move from town, and, you know, it was like someone who
was
missed. Yeah. And but in the play that I wrote, I was able instead to have it be the main character's mother who buys the house. So then it affects the main character in the story. So when you ask how you take these stories and turn it into a play, that's how I did it. I had all these stories I wanted to include.
And so you created an amalgam then through some leading characters.
That's right. That's right. I do have a lot of characters in the play because I chose to show an interrogation of someone who does get sent away, and I chose to do a scene where you see the police arriving at the house in the middle of the night and taking the family to the ferry. And so that means you need characters that aren't going to be in the play again. But you can have – one thing I've learned is you don't want a lot of characters in a play because it's too much money to produce it on stage. But some of these characters can be played by the same guy over and over. The one who keeps getting sent away.
We're talking with retired physician and playwright Maureen Longworth about her new play, Blue Ticket, Ferries, as in F-A-I-R-E-S, Ferries Out of Alaska. Mo, maybe this is an ill-informed question, but are there now laws against this? I am assuming there are, but...
Good question. You know, the reality is, any service can be refused to anyone including based on suspicion, if you're suspected of being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, whatever, people can refuse services. Right here in Juneau, technically, you could be – there are laws in our city that now give equal protection. That's brand new just this year or maybe last fall. I can't remember. But, you know, not in the state. There's no protection, equal rights, equal protection under the law. And that's true in most states. It's true on a federal level. There's still that's why when things happen against gay people, there isn't necessarily documentation or the ability to call it a hate crime or to have recourse through the all those funds that come through hate crimes. There is an option that people are not obligated to serve. People give them loans to buy a home, let them adopt children, let them co-parent, let them foster care. I mean, just everything you can think of that involves family, employment, keep a job. So the reality is with the 2015 very large advancement in gay rights federally with the Supreme Court decision to allow gay marriage, it creates actually a dangerous loophole that when some couples, and this has been documented, have announced their marriage and it's public because it is public when someone is being married. It's always announced and it's on record that they lose their jobs.
The Supreme Court is about to hear and decide on the case of the gentleman in Colorado who refused to create a wedding cake for a gay wedding. And this relates to what you're talking about. Maureen, will your readings, which are occurring this week, is that leading to a full production of a play? What is your vision?
My vision is absolutely to have it be a staged production that's done not only in Juneau but and the state of Alaska, but down south. I would love it if this play was showing in a community and one of the guys who was sent away was in the audience. And, of course, because their age is probably in their 80s at this point, and this would be guys who also withstood the AIDS crisis and survived it, you know, I would just love that I would ever meet one of these guys and just hear the real details firsthand that I've had to just sort of extrapolate by connecting the dots of all the stories I've heard.
Why do you think men were targeted instead of women? There have been gay women since women existed, I would guess. So
yes.
Why men? Is it because men were threatened by this concept of a man?
It seems like in general there's been more acceptance of women-women relationships. And I think part of it is the lack of equal power in our country.
Not a
anyway,
threat.
Is that, yes, and also as sexual objects, some men find that very erotic to think of two women together. And in fact, I think it puts lesbian women and bisexual women at increased risk for sexual trauma and harassment because people sometimes in the same way that they're objectified for sex objects. But there was a lesbian couple in Ketchikan sent away during this time.
It was not exclusively men.
No, but in Juneau, I only heard stories about men.
We're talking with retired physician Mo Longworth about her play, Blue Ticket, Ferries Out of Alaska. There will be a reading tomorrow evening, that's Wednesday at 6:30 at the Jack, and on Friday at 4 o'clock at the Andrew P. Kashaveroff Auditorium, which is at the State Library Archives and Museum. Mo, is there a charge to hear the readings?
No,
they're free and open.
And I particularly want to thank my actors, and if I could say their names.
Sure.
There's red names you're going to recognize. Zebediah Bodine, Patricia Hall, Brandon Demery, Leslie Wood, Richard Stokes, Peter Freer, and Melissa Griffiths. And these people have all volunteered their time. and Jim Simard at the museum, because it's a historical context play, was happy to host it. And at the Jack has been so supportive of me having this there. And without that, I wouldn't be able to have a free performance. And so I'm so grateful. And if you can show any extra kindness to all those people, I appreciate it.
Thank you for acknowledging them. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Fisheries reminds you, please do not feed Steller sea lions. Feeding sea lions is illegal and could result in aggressive sea lion behavior. Clean your fish and discard your fish waste out of reach of Steller sea lions. Keep your distance. Stay at least 100 yards away from these animals. Feeding, harassing, or harming Steller sea lions is illegal under federal law. To report an incident, please call NOAA Enforcement at 1-800-853-1964.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My name is Lori, your volunteer host. We've got Shelley on the board today. Our guests this afternoon are Emily Nauman and Jess Brown. They are with the Rock Dump, and they have information about tonight's community meeting. I didn't know the Rock Dump held community meetings. So first, each of you tell me what your role is at the Rock Dump and what the Rock Dump is, just in case there's someone who doesn't know.
Great. Yeah. So this is Jess here, and I have been teaching the women's class for about 8 years now, and because I got so involved and I love the Rock Dump, I was invited to be a part of the board, and so I've been on the board for almost a year now, I think. So that's what brings me here.
And Emily?
I'm also a member of the board and an avid climber and user of the Rock Dump. And for, I guess, people that don't know, the Rock Dump is the indoor climbing gym in Juneau, and it's out Thane in the Rock Dump area.
What does it cost to go use the rock dump or to take a class? Give me a sense.
So typically my classes for women are on Wednesday nights, and it's free for members and $15 for
So it is a membership organization as well.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And that's partially why we're here today, because we are a nonprofit. And so we're here to talk about our meeting tonight, which is for members. And we're going to talk about us really staying open, because I know there were some concerns earlier this year.
Emily, or either one of you want to address this, when you say concerns, was the rock dump going to close due to what, financial challenges or?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. We had hit the end of our lease for that area. We don't own the building that we're in, and our lease was terminating, and we were in some negotiations to extend the lease that eventually got resolved, but we were concerned for a long time, as were many of our users, that we wouldn't be able to continue to be in that space. And as you can imagine, the space for a rock climbing gym is very particular. So finding another space to put it in was going to be a challenge. But we worked out those issues, and we're really excited to tell the community that we're staying open, and we'd love to see you there.
About how many members does the Rock Dump have? And with that, about how many patrons does it serve, say, on an average week?
Hmm. Those are good questions.
We have about 100 subscribe members, meaning they pay, you know, auto-pay service every month, and probably an equal number of drop-in users per month, I'd say. What do you think, Jess?
Yeah, so our drop-ins vary from, you know, your birthday party on Saturday afternoon with kiddos running around to the average Joe or Jane just coming in to try it out for the first time or bringing a friend for the first time. So
can you really be average?
Yeah, absolutely. So
meaning you don't have to be in exceptional physical condition?
That's the great thing about climbing, is that it's you don't have to be some macho buff athlete to climb. And really, it's accessible to a lot of people, and I think more people than might realize. Absolutely.
So what will tonight's meeting address? Why did you think it was important enough to come and share it with the public today?
So tonight's meeting will talk about our plans for the future, what our sort of budget looks like, why it's important that we get the message out there that we're staying open, and what changes we'll be making about some of our programming and any suggestions that we can take from our members. We did a survey a couple months ago where we were asking our members and users what was important to them about programs in our new location, because at the time we thought we might be trying to find a new location. But from that survey, even though we're staying in the same place, we got a lot of great information. And so we wanted to just discuss what we heard and make sure that we have a thorough idea of what our users want and get feedback.
Is your meeting at the Rock Dump tonight or some other location?
It's at the Rock Dump.
And what time?
7 p.m.
7 o'clock tonight. We're talking with Rock Dump board members, Emily Nauman and Jess Brown. What would you say were a couple of big takeaways from the survey that occurred that might actually be, translated into changes in the future that you'd like your members to know about?
Well, it was interesting. A lot of people, we had questions, you know, like, what would be great in a new facility? And so we had people saying, like, oh, I want a sauna, or I want classes on yoga or aerial silks. And we agree those things would be great in a new facility. So we'll try and incorporate as much as we can into the same facility. Probably not a sauna, but I think the big takeaway in reading the survey results is people were like, I just want the Rock Dump to stay open. I just want a place to climb that's not just bouldering, because there are some other options in town where you might be able to just boulder.
What does that mean?
Where you're not really getting on a top rope. You're not getting too high off of the ground. So people are excited about the idea of having roped climbing, either for them or their kids. And that was another thing that people really we're excited about, youth programming, which is actually something we have coming up. So we've got some youth summer camps starting in July. So it looks like the first, second, and third week of July. And so if your kids don't have something to do those weeks, we've got some camp programming. And then we also have some homeschool programming coming up in August.
So, what does that mean, homeschool programming?
Our homeschool class is a structured 3-week program. Unlike our summer camp, which is a youth summer camp, the homeschooling has a structured curriculum to move our students through, you know, beginning rope work, even touching the holds or getting used to how to hold the holds, which are the rock imitation rock structures on the wall that help you ascend the wall. So we have an amazing teacher, Oljai, who's also our gym manager. He's a really great instructor and wonderful with kids of all ages.
And any student could take this class?
Yeah. Even if you're not enrolled in homeschool, it's $250. It's a 3-week program. It's on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 1:30 to 3, or there's an advanced class from 4:30 to 6 on those same days, July 25th through August 10th. It's just a great class to take kids from a beginning all the way through to as a functional independent climber in a teamwork situation.
And I assume that this information is probably online at some website that might be rockdump.org, or how would folks find you? We can easily Google it, but what would you recommend?
Yeah, we're using our Facebook these days.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Emily, we just have a little bit of time. In just a few words, tell me, what got you interested in climbing? What does it do for you?
Oh, I have really a deep connection with climbing. You know, it's how I got to be a strong person, both physically and mentally. And I've learned resolve and resilience from climbing, a lot of problem solving. And it's an enormous part of my life. And I'm very excited that I get to do it in Juneau. You know, it's difficult to climb outside here because it's wet. The rock is mossy. And the climbing gym allows me to stay in shape for climbing outside. I travel quite a bit to climb, and I'm really excited to be a part of that community as well.
How about you, Jess? You said you've been teaching 8 years.
Yeah.
So what was your entree into climbing?
Well, you know, I actually did an Outward Bound course right after high school. And
as a participant?
Yes, and it was mostly canoeing, and I thought, oh, this is going to be great, and ended up that I didn't like the canoeing, but I loved the 3 days of rock climbing. And so then in college, I roped my college boyfriend into it, and we started climbing all the time as much as we could. And then I moved to Juneau, and there's not a ton of outdoor climbing, so I became a little bit of a gym rat, I guess you could say. And not really, but and then I wanted to make sure that the gym was an accessible space for women. And so really, I think something that keeps me coming back these days is the community. So, and that was something we saw in the surveys too, is that people just, they really like the community feel of our rock gym in particular, that people are there to support each other, and that you really can walk in as a newbie. And the thing I love about my class is that women come in and they'll connect with each other, and then they're really close friends years later, whether or not they're still climbing. And
that's inspiring. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks, Jess. We're talking with Emily Nauman and Jess Brown. They are on the board of the Rock Dump Climbing Facility, and they are hosting a community meeting tonight at 7 at the Rock Dump to talk about what's in store for the Rock Dump. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Soon departed. his face again. That's why your love.
Have you ever watched a hummingbird hovering as it sips from blossoms filled with nectar? Early explorers to the New World were fascinated with these tiny iridescent jewels. Strictly birds of the Americas, hummingbirds don't exist in the Old World. John James Audubon, the French naturalist who spent his adult life studying and painting the birds of North America, described them as a glittering fragment of the rainbow. The only hummingbird species that Audubon observed in nature was this ruby-throated hummingbird, a summer visitor to eastern North America. The symbiotic relationship of hummingbirds with the flowers from which they feed, and in turn pollinate, was clearly understood by Audubon. He noted in his journal how the birds advance on fairy wings, carefully visiting every opening flower cup. In order to study and paint these exquisite creatures, Audubon abandoned his otherwise effective method of obtaining birds, namely shooting them, and instead poured sweetened wine into the chalices of flowers. The innocent hummingbirds drank and fell intoxicated to the ground, allowing Audubon to carefully observe their every feather. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Well, thanks for joining us this afternoon on a Juno afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling, today's volunteer host, and thanks to Shelley Delaney for producing the program today. Tomorrow on Juno afternoon, we will hear from Kate Burkhart with the Office of the Ombudsman. Mike Blackwell, City Museum, Downtown Geology Walking Tour will be on Slate tomorrow. And actors from Perseverance will be here to talk about their performances in Treadwell Gold. That's all tomorrow, June 28th. And Shelley will be in my chair then. Thank you, Shelley. Taking a quick look at the weather, scattered rain showers continuing today and tonight, as well as tomorrow. Tomorrow night, though, cloudy. That's always good news, with just a chance of rain on Thursday. Again, thanks for joining us. Have a wonderful evening.